Okay, this is episode 12 of On Drums. I'm John Simeone. Today I have my friend Sal Randazzo here today. Sal, you want to say hi?
All right. Hi, John.
Sal is a trombone player, so we were just talking about this is the third trombone player on the On Drums podcast, which makes no sense.
I just changed it to On Trombone, and it makes a lot of sense.
But who even knows three trombone players?
Well, you do now.
I know.
You're one of the only few.
You're the last one I know, I think. You're the last one I want to know. Sal and I go back to, what was the years of the...
Oh, God, you're asking me years now?
Yeah.
I mean, I was with Gus for 17 years.
So you were 17 years, and I was in 16, 15, something
like
that.
Yeah, but you stayed, I think you were on past me, and I was on before you, because we went through a couple of different drums. We had this guy, Matt Hardy, my friend Jim D'Amico played for a year or something.
In Gus's band?
Yeah.
Oh, man. I don't even know that.
Yeah, and then you came on after. I started, I guess, maybe 19.
You sure it wasn't 18?
I started about 1980, 81, something like that. Right after I got off the road with Buddy's
band. Oh, all right.
I was living in the city, and I was working with Gus. And so I went from like 1981 to 1997, something like that.
Okay, it doesn't matter. Anyway, yeah, okay. It was a long time ago.
Oh, yeah, right.
Right, so the reason that I'm doing this whole podcast, this is supposed to be like drummer's gripes, really, you know?
Okay.
And I had a million gripes. Not that band. The gripes I have now mostly with the band, the current bands, but with Gus's band, that was like the only band, club day band with players in it. Everybody played.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right?
It was a great band.
It was you went to the gig, right? First of all, there's no showcases. That was huge.
Yeah, we did maybe, in the 17 years I played with him, it's probably two showcases.
Yeah. So there were bands that did two a month.
Oh, I know.
There were no showcases. It was almost always cash, right? Almost.
I think always. I don't remember ever seeing his signature anywhere.
and there was no songs to learn, right? We didn't learn songs for weekends, did we? We just went in and played. I remember Gus going up there.
Yeah, we used to have rehearsals at his house sometimes. Yeah, Denise needed to learn a new song or something. And
right, but it wasn't like... Yeah.
No. Even when we did... I don't know. Were you on the band when we did those Canon Christmas parties?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, the big band.
The big band thing. Yeah. And then I used to take our arrangements and just write out... I wouldn't call it an arrangement, but I wrote out parts for all the horn players and the strings and stuff.
Right.
And we didn't even rehearse for that. We just put the band together and did the gig. You know?
Didn't we do a gig for the, what was the Phantom of the Opera guy?
Yeah.
With the whole band.
It was like $1 million wedding.
Wedding. And the whole band had it with those stupid masks. Yeah. And then who is the sax player?
The sax player?
The big guy. With an R. Oh, man. Not Richie. He was a band director, too. Anyway, he was playing Barry, I think, and the band had the masks on. We started the gig, and we played the first set with the masks on. And then everybody's like, "Fuck these masks, take them off." And then he was the only guy who didn't see. And then he turned around, he's like the only guy. Wearing a mask.
So he was the Phantom of the Opera. He was the Phantom of the band. You know.
So anyway, but my point was, I remember going to those gigs and just playing.
Right.
Now, you go to a gig.
Do they even have gigs anymore?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, yeah, we go any gig. This is any gig.
Well, I'm not. You're talking about wedding gigs or no? You're talking about
I'm doing mostly
top 40 stuff.
I'm doing like that now.
Yeah.
But now it's like, okay, the gig is 8 to 12. You know, it's a stupid load in. It pays $120.
Oh,
and
God.
Here's 40 songs to learn.
Oh, God.
It's ridiculous. I mean, I remember going to Gus's gigs, the drums were there already, and he would start the tunes by saying, okay,
after the 11.
Whatever, swing, B flat. He'd go 1, 2, 3, 4, and we'd play.
Right.
Everybody played.
Well, the thing with that band, too, was that, you know, we usually had, what, like 7 people, 8 people, sometimes 9.
Yeah, well, it was not 9 pieces.
There was always a core of the band. You know, the whole band never left at one time. It was always one guy in, one guy out.
Right.
So the band, you know, have a nucleus of tunes that we knew, and it was just one guy we'd have to bring along. You know, like when Frank Rizzo joined the band,
right.
He was just like,
Frank,
you know,
Rizzo.
We already had, yeah. You know, that stuff going on. So it was a little easier to to do gigs because you had John Hips. He was like
the dead guy. He was the dead guy. Dead on a gig. Yeah.
But he was great. I mean, he had all the chords, the tunes, and he just carried the whole band along and everybody. Yeah.
I miss Hips, man. He was funny.
Yeah.
He definitely was funny.
He's in Massachusetts somewhere, Western Mass.
Is it Massachusetts? Yeah. I remember the last time I spoke to him, he couldn't check his email. He had to go to the library to check his email.
Yeah, he might be in the mountains somewhere.
That's what I'm saying. Like, what?
He's somewhere near, the Berkshires and stuff.
Wow.
I don't know.
But I wonder if he's still playing. What a waste. He was great.
Yeah. I'll bet he's still playing, but maybe just at home.
Yeah. So let's get to you. Like, you didn't just play with Gus Coletti. Maybe you did some. You played with Buddy. There he is, Buddy Rich, right there. You played with the guy.
If you don't mind, I have a great
story. Life story.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I put it into three eras. I have the musician performance era, 30 years.
Yeah. Music, how old are you?
I'm going to be 70.
70.
In a couple of months. My music educator career, right? Era, 30 years.
But they overlapped a little bit, right?
Very little. Just Gus Coletti was when it overlapped because I was doing gigs on the weekends with Gus while I was still teaching and doing all of that.
Yeah.
But and then my last 10 years era is my retirement era.
Right.
So like on Halloween.
You've been out for 10 years?
Yeah. On Halloween, it'll be 10 years, this Halloween.
Wow.
I can't believe it. 10 years. So how long are you retired?
Eight years.
You're retired 8 years?
8 years, yeah.
That's amazing. Right?
From teaching.
So out of my three eras, my best era is my last 10 years.
Of course, yeah.
I mean, everybody underrates retirement. It's like the best thing in the
world. Well, your retirement's a normal retirement. I'm like retired, like an Uber driver for three little kids. I drive around all day.
Yeah, I'm lucky. When I retired, my kids were already grown, so we were pretty much empty nesters and everything.
I have to hang out with people who are, 20 years my junior, and their parents of my kids' friends.
Yeah.
And I got to hear this whole other generation talk about shit. I want to strangle them. like their kids to me.
Right, right.
And they had their kids with my kids. Exactly. I can't tell you how many students, we went to Disney Epcot last spring.
Yeah.
And one of my students is in charge of the staff. Wow. So she said, you have to stop by my office. And we did. And she got us on a ride. And she's a year older than my wife.
Oh, jeez.
I try to explain it to my kids. Like, how is that possible? If she was just like, I don't know.
Yeah, I have Brian Dunn was one of my students. And he's 50.
Brian's 50, is he?
Yeah, 57 or something. And he was my student in high school.
He's great.
Man. And he's only a couple of years younger than my wife. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But anyway.
So go ahead.
So here's a great story for you. All right. I probably should have been a pizzeria owner and be making pizzas my whole life.
I can't wait to see where this is going.
And it's all fate because what happened. When I was 3 years old, there was a show on TV called Lawrence Welk. This was in the 50s.
Sure, I remember that
show. Lawrence Welk was a big band and he had all these, it was a crazy show.
Very anyway, white. It was a very white show.
One day he gets a little Dixieland group out of the big band up in front and the trombone player is playing the tune with his foot on the slide. And he's moving the slide with his foot, with a bare foot. And I, as a three-year-old, I thought it was I said,
why,
Mommy.
Wait, can I ask why he was doing that?
I don't know. It was just a novelty thing. He was trying to show off or something. And I saw that as a three-year-old, and I pointed to it, and I said, Mommy, I want to do that. I want to play the trombone.
That guy fucked up your life.
He fucked up my life. That was it. I could have been making pizzas. I probably would have been a billionaire.
You would have
been
retired 30 years ago. So you'd have three more houses.
Yeah. So anyway, as soon as I got a little older, maybe 5, 6, my mother brings me to Music Land in Lindenhurst because we lived in Lindenhurst, and that was a place they had back then before they downgraded. They had all these music lesson rooms along the side.
I remember it.
And I asked him. My mother said, "He wants to learn how to play the trombone." And so the trombone teacher, whoever it was at the time, I don't even remember if I met a trombone teacher or not, but he said, no, he's too small. He can't hold the horn.
Can't get the sixth position.
So he says, why don't you play the accordion instead?
At the pizzeria.
This is a true story, though. So my mother said, okay, accordion. So we rented an accordion, and I started taking lessons at Musicland on the accordion.
They gave lessons on accordion?
Yeah. Well, back in, I'm talking 19, if I was 5, 6 years old, it was 1960. 60s,
yeah.
1960. So I did this for 6 months and I hated it. The guy, I used to go home crying. The guy was mean to me. He wasn't a motivator. He was a, whatever, a drill sergeant. So I quit it. accordion after 6 months. And I still have, to this day, I have the little strap that you snap on to hold it with,
right,
in somewhere in a closet. And I always look at this thing and I say, son of a bitch, that accordion teacher. You know. So then finally, when in Lindenhurst, summer third grade, they have a program where you could take a music lesson. So that's where I met, that's where my whole fate changed. Because at that time, my father had one of the first pizzeria places in Lindenhurst. It was called Annie's Pizzeria, named after my mom.
Uh-huh.
And he was at
the I didn't know any of that.
Oh, yeah. He was at the pizzeria place all day long. My mother would work there. She would run home when I'd get home from school and everything. And then we'd go to the pizza place, and I'd hang out in the back of the pizza place. But anyway, come summer third grade, I meet my mentor, my life mentor, and that's Julie Rubin. I don't know if you know who Julie Rubin
is. I don't know
who
that is.
He was a music teacher, elementary music teacher in Lindenhurst. He lived right down the street here on Allen Street in East Islip. And
he must be dead, right?
He passed away just 2 years
ago.
Yeah. So he starts teaching me trombone. So
At school.
And in the summer music program. And then he happened to be the elementary teacher at Albany Avenue Elementary School, which is where I went. So now in fourth grade, I have him as my elementary band teacher. And we do it for about a year. And he tells my mother, you know, your son's really good. He should take private lessons. And back then, it wasn't, no, nowadays you can't do that. But he recommended I take private lessons with him.
Right.
And at the time, it was at Musicland. So I started taking lessons with him at Musicland for about a year or so. And then Musicland was horrible. They were not paying well or whatever. And he recommended we take private lessons at home. So he came to my home, and he talked my mother into buying a spinet piano. Now, Julie Rubin, you don't know Julie Rubin, but he was in all the big bands in the 40s and everything. He was a big, you know, heavy-duty big band trombone player. So he was the guy who started getting me interested in music. And my father died when I was in second grade. I was at seven. So
I didn't know that either.
Yeah. So my mom raised me as a single parent all through high school. And Julie Rubin became my mentor and my substitute father, whatever.
Right. Surrogate
father, that's what I was thinking of. So he not only started teaching me trombone, but he got me into hockey, which to this day I'm still in. We went to Ranger games in the city together. There was no Islanders at the time. He taught me handball. And we remained best friends. And he taught me privately all through high school until I went away to college. And that was what sparked my interest in becoming a musician.
Wow.
If it wasn't for him. Now, my father, if he hadn't died when I was 7 years old, he'd still have the pizza place.
Right.
I would have been making pizzas with him. And that would have been my whole life,
right,
probably. It would have been probably good. I mean, there's a lot of people that made a lot of money doing that. But I think music was my calling.
Right.
So that was it. And, you know, and through Julie Rubin interesting me and everything else. In fact, when he died 2 years ago, he had several trombones. We played the same model, and he willed his best trombone to me. So I have his trombone now.
Wow.
Yeah, we remain good, best friends.
That's cool. That's a stand-up guy right there, right? You don't really see too much of that.
It's unbelievable.
You couldn't, like you said, you could. Nowadays, a teacher would be really aware to do any of that.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
I know.
That's
a
shame.
It's a shame.
It is a shame.
You know,
because there are kids who need that.
He realized I needed that. Yeah. I didn't have a father figure in my life, and he became the father. And he had a son. He had two sons and two daughters as well. But none of them were as interested in music as I. He saw that I had a big interest. And because of him, I ended up, he put me in the all-elementary district jazz band, which he headed. He got me real into all of that. And then in high school, I had a band director, Bernie Wojcicki.
Bernie Wojcicki.
He was my high school band director.
Bernie Wojcicki was here, East Islip.
Yeah.
Right?
And I took his position in East Islip when he retired.
Oh, that's right.
But Bernie was into big bands. And when I was in high school, we had, the jazz ensemble. And he got me interested in playing jazz and everything like that.
Uh-huh.
And then I got into the very first all-state jazz ensemble. The very first one. You know Billy Drews, right?
Sure.
Yeah, well, Billy and I, and I don't know if you knew Dennis
Bill Wolf. Bill Drews, not Glenn Billy Drews.
No, Glenn's his brother.
Okay,
his brother,
so Billy's I don't know Billy then. What's
Billy's this alto player with the Vanguard band.
And okay.
And he's well-known. He plays all around the world. He's an amazing sax player. But Billy and I and Dennis Wilson, also from West Babylon, because it was a great jazz program in West Babylon, too, this guy Bill Titone, and he had the Town of Babylon All-Star Jazz Band, and we were all in that. And this guy by the name of Bill Katz.
Oh, I know Bill Katz.
You know Bill
because
Katz?
Because I had, what's his daughter's name?
I don't know his daughter. Bill's a bassoon player.
My first year at Beach Street, I had a Katz.
Oh.
And they said, you know, she's Bill Katz's daughter. And I had no idea who Bill Katz was, and I found out later. Yeah.
So Bill Katz kept petitioning NISMA for years. We had an all-state chorus, all-state wind ensemble, all-state band. He said, we need an all-state jazz ensemble. So he finally talked them into it. And I happened to be lucky, me, Billy, and this guy, Dennis Wilson from West Babylon, the only three that we knew each other. We all were in the first all-state jazz ensemble and played at the Concord Hotel.
Wow.
And I was in 10th grade at the time. Then in 11th grade, Billy and Dennis went on to Berkeley. But in 11th grade, I was in the second jazz ensemble, and the band director there for the jazz ensemble, all-state jazz, was Phil Wilson, which was my Berkeley connection. He was the jazz trombone player at Berkeley. And he said, oh, you should come to Berkeley. And that's what made me go to Berkeley.
Right, right.
So it all, you know.
It's funny how that works, right?
It's all fate. I mean, if it wasn't for my father dying, wasn't for Julie Rubin, it wasn't for Bernie Rejeski, Bill Titone, then Phil Wilson, that's what brought me to Berkeley. And then in Berkeley, I had another whole experience there. It was amazing, you know. Right. I mean, I was in the great ensembles there, the recording band with Herb Pomeroy, the Dues band with Phil Wilson. We used to do concerts in the area. I remember once we even backed up Tony Bennett in Rhode Island. I mean, we did all kinds of great things in Berkeley. I had a band who is now my brother-in-law, but we were best friends in Berkeley. We started a band called Pinocchio. It was a quintet, and we played music from the Miles Davis quintet of the 50s and 60s. All that stuff, you know, Pinocchio, all those tunes, Infant Eyes, you know, all that whole era, that whole genre. And we played little pubs and stuff in Boston while I was going to school.
It's a shame there's no market for that now.
I know.
It's nuts, man.
But, you know, we're resurrecting that band.
Really?
In 2020. Really?
Resurrecting is the right word, too.
Yeah, right. If we're all still alive.
You have to dig everybody up.
I know. Well, the rhythm section was Japanese. Our really good friends from Tokyo went to Berkeley. Shiro Mori on guitar, Jun Saito on drums, and Hiroshi Kishimoto on bass.
Those guys went to Berkeley?
Yeah, anyway, we're all at Berkeley together. And they're all made big names for themselves. They went back to Japan, and they're all like pretty famous jazz players in Japan. Anyway, so our plan is in 2025 now, me and my brother-in-law are going to fly to Tokyo and spend a couple of weeks there and get that band together and do gigs in the Tokyo area.
Oh, that is
because
great.
Because there's still a market, believe it or not, there's still a market.
Well, because culturally, they're always ahead of us.
Europe and Japan, I mean, you know, there's still, over here, jazz, where's jazz, you know? You know, you've got some clubs in the city.
This is why I'm doing this shit, because this is what bothers me about music right now. Like, I don't think this would happen in Japan. Like, what other profession can you think of where you could say, I dabble in it on the weekends? Like, so you spend your whole life studying to be, let's say, an accountant, okay? And I'm not an accountant, but I read up a little bit. And I say, I do some taxes on the weekends. Who does that? Like, this is the only profession where you could go to Samish, buy a guitar, and say, I play a little guitar. And then go get a gig at a fucking, get paid like, you know, 20 bucks. You're getting paid 20 bucks a night. You're undercutting every guy who's legitimately a guitar player.
Right.
And you're doing you are a guitar player. As far as the people in the cafe are concerned, you're a guitar player.
Right. Yeah.
There is no other profession like that.
Right. I know. It's crazy.
Terry's take on it is great, because Terry Gnagrelli's like, you know, the amount of schooling you go through to get what you are, and it's like, it becomes nothing. It's like anybody can do it because it's just fun.
I know.
Check this out. I'm sitting in I don't give a shit. I'm sitting in an open house for my kids in middle school, and the band director is telling, you know, the parents, us, what's expected. You know, if they miss a lesson, they got to make it up.
Right.
You know,
so
one of the parents raises their hand and says, what if my son has science and he has lessons? And the band director says, she goes, he's got to come to lessons. She goes, well, can he miss lessons that period because it's in science? And she says, well, yeah, but he can make it up, but he can only make up a certain amount of lessons, and that's going to affect his grade.
Right.
The parent could have left it at that. Instead, she says, well, I would rather him miss band than science.
Yeah, right.
So she's really saying, your credentials, which is the same as the science teacher,
right,
are not as good or not as powerful as the, somehow science is the thing now. Yeah. Like, they're not equal, you know, because this is just entertainment. And that's what bugs me, man.
Well, yeah, I went through that all the time. And I was in three different districts, and we had different policies for lessons in every one. But the backside of that was the parents' complaint was, well, science is five periods a week, or let's say math is five periods. Science sometimes has a lab, but math is five periods a week. And band is five periods a week, so why now you're adding a sixth period onto band? Well, so the argument to that was, it's like science, and you have the labs too.
Right.
So, you know, but that's the program. But, I mean, you can't have a band without having a lesson program. You can, but it'll be a shitty band.
But just the idea that we're in the music entertainment business. We're here at your pleasure,
right?
To make you smile when you're drinking. That bothers me, man. That really, really bothers me.
I know. Thank God I'm past all that now. You know, I forgot what I did in education. I already forgot.
I'm trying to forget.
And that's a good thing. Like I don't, because my kids are out of school. I mean, I went through the same thing with you when I went to my kids' open houses and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, they've been out of public school now. My son's out 5 years already. So, you know, my youngest son. So, I mean, I don't even remember. People say, what did you do when you were a director in Half Hour Hills? Oh, gee, I have to think about it.
I couldn't tell you.
It's great because, you know, I used to, my first couple of years out, I mean,
both my kids.
I used to think about it and worry about, you know, what's going on. Really? I used to worry, you know, the district was going to sustain the programs. And now I'm so far gone.
I drove out of the parking lot after retiring. I didn't even look back. I just left. I don't even think I cleaned out my desk.
Wow.
I think I left the thing, whatever. Wow. Anyway, I have kids. My kids are now playing clarinet, and now I'm back to teaching clarinet. Like, I'm sitting down here with a clarinet, doing, you know, concert B flat scale.
Oh God, yeah.
So, anyway.
So again, we're talking about the music industry, whatever. It was very different back then. When I got out of Berkeley, I graduated Berkeley in '75. There were still big bands, you know. There's a couple now, right? Yeah, but I mean, back then it was a big thing. You had Woody Herman's band, you had Maynard Ferguson's band, Buddy Rich's band.
Right, like gigging bands.
You had all these bands that, you know, you tried to get on. And it was not like, I don't know how they do it today, but there was no auditions or anything. I mean, when I got out of Berkeley, like I mentioned before, Dennis Wilson, he was a year ahead of me because I had got to Berkeley a year after him. So when he graduated Berkeley, he went right into Lionel Hampton's band. And then he moved from there to Count Basie's band.
Right.
And when I graduated Berkeley, he just recommended, he's moving to Count Basie. Oh, Sal Randazzo, take him.
They must do auditions now.
No, I don't know, but there's no. So I just went on the first gig, opened the book, sight read the book, and if you either sunk or you swam, you know.
Right.
And that's how you did it. Same thing with Buddy's band. Years later, when I was on Buddy's band, Roger Homefield was a friend of mine from Berkeley. He was on Buddy's band. He was leaving, and he told the manager, whatever it was, he said, "Oh yeah, Sal Randazzo's available. Why don't you call him? He'll do it." And the first gig I did with Buddy was in Atlantic City at that big place where they used to have the beauty pageants or something. It was a big gig. And I just sat there, opened up the book, and sight-read the book.
You sight-read the Buddy Rich book on the first gig in Atlantic
City?
First gig in Atlantic City.
Yeah. Yeah. Although, just before the gig, in the back, in the green room.
You're, like, looking it over.
Well, yeah, I looked over. But also, you know, some of the charts were very well written and everything. Some of them look like chicken scratch.
Yep.
And, like, the big charts, like Good News and West Side Story, they had edited so many times and cut this. Roadmaps. You had to be like Rand McNally, as Richie Scola would say. Yeah, you had to be Rand McNally to get through it.
And nobody knows who Rand McNally is now.
No, I know. Everybody's got GPS, right? But anyway, so that was the gig.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got on and I was nervous as shit, you know, but you get on, you play the gig. And I remember after the thing was over, I was worried, you know, what he thought. And he came over to me and goes,
"Who?"
"Buddy."
Oh.
He goes, he called me Randazzo. You know, he didn't call me by my first name. Yeah, Randazzo. Not bad. He says, "A little loud." He says, "Be careful. Don't play too loud." That's the only thing he told me.
That's a lot from Buddy Rich. Though.
Yeah, I know.
That's a lot of input.
Well, the other thing was I sat right next to him, so he probably thought it was loud because he couldn't hear anybody else because his cymbals were so freaking loud.
I got a Buddy Rich story.
Oh, I got plenty of Buddy Rich stories.
I mean, but I didn't play with him. I was a kid. You know, I used to play East Side of High School.
Oh,
and
yeah.
my parents, my dad would take me. And my dad had this thing, he had to get an autograph all the time. That's that autograph right there on that page.
Oh, yeah.
So somebody at work went to a thing, got an autograph for me, and I had it. So I had that picture with Buddy Rich's autograph. And my dad's like, "Well, we're going to see Buddy Rich and sign it again." So we go.
You were playing drums at the time.
I was playing drums,
right?
Yeah,
yeah, great. That's
so
great.
We waited for him, and he came in with like two guys, I guess, on bodyguards, whatever they were. And my father had the picture, and I was like 12 or something.
Yeah.
And my dad said, "Would you mind, Mr. Ritchie, mind signing this?" And he handed him the picture. He went to sign it, and then he handed it back and said, it's already got one. And he's
one.
And my father said, "Yeah, could you do it again?" And he like reluctantly signed. And I was in my mind, I was told, I was like, "Fuck this guy! I don't care how good he plays. This shit is not." He was so like nasty to a kid. You know, I was a kid. You know that.
In other words, it had his signature from another time.
There's, if you look at that picture right there, there's two signatures from Buddy Rich.
Yeah, from two different concerts.
Right, and he didn't want to do it again.
Oh,
because he was Buddy Rich. Oh, I do too.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, I got a lot of good stuff.
Anyway, so go ahead, talk what you're doing.
So yeah, so that was that, and that's how I got into the that whole thing with Lionel Hampton's band.
Right. So it's sort of like everything else, right? It's band to band. It's
Who you know, and you know, you gotta have to play. You gotta be able to play, but it's really who you know. If I didn't know those guys, I never would have got on that band. If I didn't go to Berkeley, you know. So again, it's all fate. Going back from the pizzeria, it's all fate. That's how I look at it, you know.
Yep.
And then after Lionel Hampton, I got a little, you know, this disenchanted with that, because he was kind of like Buddy.
Was he,
you know,
really? What's with that, man?
Yeah, very, you know. He didn't treat us like I thought we should have been treated. Anyway, so then I was also in Long Island, because Lionel Hampton's band, we didn't go out on the road for long periods of time. It was only like one night, as we would all meet in New York City by his apartment, get on a bus and do a one night to Pennsylvania, one night to Rhode Island, one night at, you know, Washington, whatever. And we stayed fairly much local. Once in a while, we did a 1 week tour somewhere. But, you know, so then I was living back at home at my mom's house in Lyndhurst. And Richie Iacona had that little big band thing going on.
Didn't Richie Skoll do that one?
Well, that's what I'm leading to. Exactly what I'm leading to, yeah. So he used to rehearse in the basement of his house in Copaig. And one day I'm in there rehearsing, and there's this saxophone player in the sax section talking about screw ships. And I'm listening.
And it's Richie.
And it's Richie Skoll. And so I said, "Oh yeah." I said, "Gee, really?" He said, "Yeah, I played on he was doing Princess Cruises with his brother out on the West Coast and everything." He said, "Oh, it's great."
Bobby.
Yeah, you know.
Bobby Skoll.
With Bobby. So I started talking to him. He goes, "Yeah." He says, "I'm getting ready to do this cruise with Carnival Cruise Lines, and I think they're looking for a trombone player." I said, "You know, sounds great. I think I want to do that." "Oh, great. Yeah, you can come over. We're going to go in this, get a meet in the city, go on to Penn Station, go down to Norfolk, Virginia, and all of this stuff." So then Iacona sees me talking and everything. So he pulls me off to the side. I don't know if you ever heard this story. And he goes, "Sally," he said, "you're talking to Richie Skoll?" "Yeah, yeah." He was talking about Crucci. He says, "Yeah." He says, "You know he's gay, right?"
I knew it. I knew he was gay. I always thought he was gay.
No, he's not gay.
I know he's not gay.
But it was so funny. It was, and you know, you could just picture, I can imagine what my face looked like. My jaw probably dropped. Like, this guy's getting me on a cruise ship and he wants probably room with me, you know. So then Richie goes, "Nah, I'm only kidding. I'm only kidding." Right. Ah, okay. So anyway, that's how Richie and I met.
Right, Richie.
And it
Richie,
was love at first sight. I mean, and Richie and I, you know,
and that's,
it was great.
And that, so that's how Richie, you guys got into Gus's band, I guess, right? Because one of you had to get in first and get the other guy?
Yeah, I don't remember. I think I was there first. Yeah, I was, because I think Joel Levy was before Richie.
Was it Joel?
Yeah, Joel was playing sax. So then Richie and I, we did the Carnival Cruise for, I don't know, 6-8 months or something. And then we got off. And then there was a new ship, the Festival, opening up, and they needed a band director, and they asked me to be the band director and the you know, the conductor for the shows and everything. So I asked Richie to come back and join me, and that's when I got my friend Ron Ruvio. I got a couple of...
All Italian guys.
Yeah,
Jim
D'Amico.
Bunch of Italian guys.
Yeah, we had a great band. We called it Hocus Pocus. And that was our theme song. Lee Morgan, I don't know if you know the Lee Morgan tune, Hocus Pocus. That was our theme song and everything. And that's how, you know, Richie and I developed a great relationship all these years and everything. And
right. So
and that was great. Right, and then when I got off the cruise ships, I that's when I got asked to go with Buddy's band. And that was the same thing, like I said. My friend Roger was getting off, and he asked...
Oh, so you knew Richie before you went on that band? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Richie, I was just thinking about Richie.
Yeah.
I know he's going to be listening to this podcast. I don't give a shit.
Hi, Richie.
But he was funny for sure. As good as he
Richie,
was.
Out of all my friends, he's the funniest guy.
As good as he was on tenor, he was that funny. He was definitely funny.
He was.
And I remember, you remember this too. We used to, on the gigs, we'd go up and do a first set, and it'd be, you know, first chorus, blah, 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 right? And then you get to the the last course, the, oh, sorry, the dessert, yeah. cake, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the way we talked about coffee,
yeah.
it would, because it's, I think it was Jim Cherry who would say, Avez Zordu, right? Avez Zord is your sister's ass, right? Your sister's ass in Italian. Yeah. But he'd go, Avez Zordu at the end, right? And then Richie made that, Gatsini Gavez Zordu, right? Yeah. So then it got even different, more different. It got to the point where we did it so many times. When coffee was served, Richie would go, Where's the Gatsini?
That's great.
He looks so Italian.
Here's my funniest moment with Richie Scolo on the Gus Coletti band. And I think you were the drummer at the time. If not, it was Matt Hardy. But anyway, we're playing. And I don't know if you remember the horn section. We had these little monitors on, yep. on mic stands.
Yep.
And we used to try to crank them up to hear ourselves. But we couldn't hear ourselves because right behind us were the Bose speakers.
I know what you're going to say.
With Gus's voice coming out of it and John Hipps's keyboards.
Right.
And they were like, if 10 was maximum, Gus and John Hipps. Gus was 11.
They were 12.
Gus was 11. John Hipps was 10, and the horns were 2.
Yep.
And we couldn't hear. So we're playing, you know, bop, ba-da, with whatever song we're playing. And I look, and Richie's always, I think it was always to my left. And I look to my left, and he's not there. And I'm where's Richie? Where's Richie? I turn
he's
around.
He's behind the speaker.
He's behind. He's got the speaker in his hands behind the speaker like a machine,
like a machine gun.
And he's going. Because it was so loud, it was so appropriate, and I stopped playing. Couldn't play.
That I remember that
you
gig
remember
distinctly,
that?
And the thing that precipitated that was Gus wanted the people to go home, so he said, "All right, let's get rid of him," and he turned it up, and that's when Richie got.
That was so funny. That was to this shit. Day. I'll never forget that.
That was
day.
Some funny
that
stuff.
That was a great day.
Remember the fist fight between him and Jim Cherry? At
no.
Yeah, it was at maybe you was.
Wait, fist fight Jim Cherry and who?
Richie.
And Richie Scolo?
Yeah.
No, Richie, I wasn't there.
Richie
I would have remembered.
Yeah, yeah.
I would have remembered.
It was
that.
At the place with the loading.
Literally dog. A fist fight?
Well, they got in each other's way or something.
Really?
And they started.
Richie, of all people, he's like the most mild
man. Yeah, you call Richie after he'll tell you that. Well, Jim
pushed Cherry
him,
must have really
pushed him to
some,
you know
push some
was.
Wrong
yeah.
buttons there, yeah.
Yeah, he was the button pusher, man.
Oh,
what
okay.
Richie used to say to Jim Cherry, and for those of you who don't know, Jim Cherry's a great singer, but he looked like an accountant. He did not
right.
look like a singer.
Yeah,
so
well,
Richie said, always say to Jim, you know, I think maybe this is why Jimmy didn't like him. He'd say, you know, when they were giving out voices, you got on the wrong line, man. You should have been on the accountant line. You should have, somehow you got on the R&B line with the accountant body.
Yeah, he didn't look right. Yeah. He didn't look like an R&B
right,
singer. Right, exactly. You would think he was black or something.
Right, he was great.
He sounded
He really
great.
Was great.
He was great. I tell you, we had great moments with that band. I have, to this day, I have to thank the fact that I was with that band for all those years after I had gotten off the road. If it wasn't for Gus Coletti's band, I probably wouldn't have been able to buy. I bought a house.
I know.
The same year when I got married, I bought a house. My wife and I moved into a house. We never had an apartment. We bought our own house. And it was because I was doing not only teaching, but I was doing 150 gigs a year with
right.
Gus.
See, and now for me, it screwed me up in the opposite way because I was single and I had all this cash laying
yeah.
around. I didn't know. I didn't understand.
Yeah.
I thought you just had hundreds on you all the time. I was right. buying stupid shit.
Yeah.
I could have bought two houses,
yeah.
but I was buying boats and cars. I didn't give. You know, I was like what, 33 or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had an apartment for $400 a month. I had all this money.
Yeah.
And I thought that was normal. You
yeah.
know.
Yeah. Well, and it was for someone who was single, but. You know, well, you were lucky to do that, but you know, yeah, but you try, you're right.
I could
as soon
have
as you're married. You know, your
everything
priority
changes right.
and you know,
yeah. I could have you know bought a house outright. I'm pretty sure of that.
Yeah.
If I had thought about it. You know, I had nobody.
Yeah. Yeah, and back then, houses, when I bought my house, it was $118,000.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like, you know, it's unheard of today
yeah.
to buy a house for that.
It was a good run. I remember that, though. It was fun. And I forget how I left. I think, well, the band was kind of like ending, wasn't it? Yeah, after you left.
I'm not sure. I left. He kept calling me back to sub in there, but then I was so busy. I had gotten that job at East Islip.
East Islip, yeah.
And I was so busy with that gig. That was a crazy gig. You know, I was director for the whole district, and I couldn't do it anymore. I just
yeah.
couldn't do it. I did one or two, and then that was the end of it.
But I actually left because I joined a different band because I thought, I don't remember, this was like 20 years ago. I thought Gus was like, you know, ending it. He was like just stopping the gigs.
Yeah. Well, his health was waning.
He got help,
yeah,
right?
Was,
he had
yeah.
a problem.
But yeah, it was. But you know, he was in his heyday. I mean, he was the Narragansett, yep. you know, house band. He was the Crest Hollow house band.
Yep.
We were all over the place.
I have to say, he was a good singer, man.
He was a great entertainer for the songs he sang. His bass playing, you know, that was the only
I think
problem.
We all agree on that.
Yeah.
The best was the pipe bass that was on a stand with a, he had that crazy expensive bass with a pipe going through it to hold it up so he could just go behind it and not have to wear a strap.
Yeah.
And then the gloves. He used to wear gloves.
The gloves. Yeah. Oh, boy. But yeah, no, you know, hey, like I said, so again, going back to the pizzeria,
right.
it's all for everything lined up in
right.
a row.
Right.
You know, but I got some good buddy stories if you want to hear
yeah,
some of those.
Yeah, yeah, what do you got? Shoot, man.
Okay, so anyway, buddy, he used to, in the year and a half I was on a band, we went through 19 bass players.
Yeah, because they couldn't stand it. Yeah,
because and the reason why I counted them is because I was the second trombone chair was next to Buddy, and right behind me was the bass. I was the one that always leaned back and said, "Skip letter B, go to letter C," you know, stuff like that. And he knew that I knew the book really well and everything. So every time we hired a new bass player, I was the guy who had to sit with him and show him
right.
the roadmaps, and he never could find a good bass player.
But he didn't like any bass.
He didn't get. No, we had some great bass players.
But he didn't like any of them, right?
No, I know, because he was just a nut.
Yeah.
But he finally found a bass player he liked, and that was Mike Hall.
Oh, Mike Hall.
Yeah, Mike. Mike was the bass player for like the last 6 months I was on the band. We went to Europe together.
There's two Mike Halls, isn't there? Because
Mike Hall, the bass player. His wife is Robin Hall. She's the jazz vocalist. Does like Mayo and all that stuff.
There's definitely two Mike Halls because somebody was talking about, oh, my friend Ken Talvey plays guitar, and he was talking about getting Mike Hall to cover the bass part. But
it's
I think
probably
it's,
the same Mike Hall.
Could it be the same
is
Mike
it
Hall?
Two Mike Hall bass players?
He's acoustic
and electric. He's great. He's like one of the best bass players I've ever played. He's a great guy. And anyway, so Mike was finally the last one.
And Buddy actually liked Mike.
Yeah.
He
actually got mad when we were in London. And we had had it. We were on the band for a long time, and we had just finished doing a tour of the UK and everything. And me, Mike, and I think it was the lead trumpet player at the time. Somebody's calling my phone. I'm going to ignore it. Me, Mike Hall, lead trumpet, and one or two other people, I think a sax player or something, we all went in, because we were all afraid to talk to him by ourselves. We all went in and gave him our 2 weeks' notice.
Buddy.
Yeah.
Oh shit.
And we were going back to New York, and then we were supposed to go to Tokyo a couple of weeks later. And to this day, I regret. I should have went to Tokyo. I still never got to Tokyo. I'm hoping to go next
year.
Yeah, but I mean, I should have gone to Tokyo first, and then
quit. Right.
But anyway, we all quit, and he hated us for it. What, you're leaving me? And that was it. And we all left on bad terms with Buddy. But
2 weeks is two. I mean, what did?
Yeah, I mean,
did he give guys 2 weeks notice when he fired him? No.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
He did.
Oh yeah.
So 2 weeks.
His big line was call your friends, because call your friends meant you had to go look for another gig. Call your friends. Hey Bill, call your friends. He's got 2 weeks. You know. So it was crazy. But anyway, so what was I going to say? A couple of funny stories. We had at the time I was on a band. We had Dave LaLama. You know Dave?
Sure.
Piano player.
Yeah.
And Mike Hall was playing bass. Yep. And the two of those guys, you know, great jazz players and everything, but they never had a chance to play together because on Buddy's band, you had to just read these charts and play with Buddy. Boom, So they would go, we'd go to the town we're playing in. The bus would drop the band off at the hotel. The bus would continue on to the venue and set up. Me and the first trombone player, Glenn Frank, I used to get paid extra. We would set up the band. And,
what do you mean, set up the band?
You know,
chairs?
Chairs, stands, his drum set. Glenn taught me, Glenn was first at it. He taught me how to set the drums. You had to, very specifically, you know, the tom-tom had to be taped to the snare and the angles. And there was a plywood board that you had to put, there was a mark for every stand where it went.
Oh my God.
It had to be exactly right. And so I ended up inheriting that job. I would set up his drums and everything. And then sometimes Dave and Mike would go to the venue just to play together.
Right.
You know, because they never get a chance,
So
they'd sit down and play tunes. So I don't know if you know, I don't have any chops, but I play a little drums. I have a good sense of time, and I have a drum set. I've always had a drum set, and I could, you know, do easy swing and a little bossa nova.
Yeah, you know what? Just keep behind that thought. I remember there was a gig at Gus's band where I was somehow late from getting back from a break.
Really?
And you were playing drums.
Oh, really?
Right? And then the band, because they started without me, and you were playing drums, and then I just kind of slipped in behind you, and as soon as I started to play, Richie said, "Oh, what happened to the time?"
So anyway, so here's the funny part of the story. So after I set up his drums while they're playing, I sat down on the drums, on Buddy's drums.
Yeah.
And I started playing trio with them. We're playing some tunes, just light stuff. And I never expected Buddy to find out. I didn't want him to know that I played his drums because I think he would have probably fired me on the spot. So as we're playing, I forgot what tune we were playing, you know, some tune. Who walks in the back of the hall? Buddy.
Oh, geez.
And he sees me playing the drums. And he walks up, and I'm like, oh, shit, I'm starting to sweat and everything. So he comes up, and we finish the tune. Hey, buddy, how you doing? Hey, man, even Dazzo. He says, not bad, not bad. That's all he said to me. And then I got off the drums, and we finished setting up, and that was the end of it.
Oh, so you're okay? Lucky. You guys had a good day. Yeah.
All right, now here's the crazy part of it. About a month later, we're doing a tour with Mel Torme. We're doing a month tour or a 3-week tour or something with Mel. He's actually on the bus with us, and we're traveling around the country. And Mel would get out and sing some tunes. Well, one day on the gig, for some reason, it only happened as once. I wish I could remember more, but it only happened once. Mel invites Buddy up to sing with him on this duo, some silly kind of a tune or something.
Yeah.
And so Buddy gets up and he looks at me, he goes, Rendazzo, he says, get on the drums.
So you played drums.
So I played drums with Buddy Rich Band.
And Mel Torme.
Yeah, with the Buddy Rich Band. And I don't even remember what song it was. It was some just a swing thing, you know, just to keep some time. And that was it. And that was my one claim to fame.
That is hilarious,
that
man.
Isn't that funny?
You know what's funny? I have another Buddy Rich memory. I don't know, it's all this Buddy Rich stuff, but when I was kind of in doing those things, going to East Islip High School, we used to go to all the concerts, and it was one, somehow my father got me backstage again, and nobody was there except the bass player and some other guy who wasn't a drummer playing drums, and wasn't, I'm sure it wasn't you, and they were just like doing a sound check or something, and then they got off, and my father was like, get up there, man, just get up, and I could see, my really? Mind's eye, I could still see the kid, it was like 5 feet in front of me, from the back. And I was like, no way, man. And my dad's like, just get up there. It's Buddy Rich. Just try. And I wouldn't do it. And I regret it now, but yeah. I was like, there was no fucking way I was climbing.
Well, he would
have
probably shot you.
Yeah, well, there you go. And then you'd all be better off at this point.
But yeah, he was very unpredictable.
Yeah.
But I have to say, in the time I was on the band, for some reason he liked me. We never had, except when I gave him my notice.
Yeah.
Up until that point, he always, I was an early bird. I would get up in a hotel. I'd go up and have breakfast 7:30, 8 o'clock, and he was too. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we'd be in the hotel coffee shop, and we'd sit down together, and he would actually talk and have a little breakfast. Very rare, but
right. It
was, you know, he was, but a couple of funny stories, you know, with the Buddy Rich tapes, of course, you know.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah.
But he would, not only the bass players, but he would fire the whole band one by one.
Oh, make them fly out? Oh, I heard that story.
Well,
fly out and rehire them.
Here's how it would happen. Steve Marcus was the straw boss on the band, right? And he was the go-between between the band members and Buddy. So we'd have a bad set for some reason, you know, one of the trumpet players came in wrong or the bass player was dragging. And we get off the bandstand and he says, Marcus, in my dressing room right now. And so we go, band would all be like, oh, what's going on? So Steve would go into his dressing room. He'd go, Marcus, he said, that trumpet player, give him 2 weeks' notice. Want me to fire him? Yeah, yeah. He said, in fact, fire the whole trumpet section. And then he would go on and on. And little by little, he'd say, I want a whole new band. We get back to New York. He says, I want a whole new band. We're going to find a whole new band. So then Steve would say, gee, buddy, Sal Rendazzo, you sure Sal Rendazzo... Sal can stay.
Yeah.
What about Glenn? Glenn's, you know. No, Glenn's all right. All right. And he would go through about 10, 15 guys, and he said, no, all right. And then, just fire the bass player.
Right.
And that's how he fired the bass player. He'd start off firing the whole band. And then he fired the bass player. And that happened probably 5 or 6 times when I was on the band.
He's a lunatic. The story I heard was some guy who stood up to Buddy Rich, like a tenor player or something, said, you know, I quit. I'm leaving. I'm not doing it again. He quit. He flew home. And then and then Buddy Rich called him wherever he flew to and said, listen, man, I'm sorry about the misunderstanding. Come back. I need you on the gig, blah, blah, blah. Guy flies back, gets to the gig, and Buddy Rich goes, nobody quits this band. You're fired. That's the story I heard.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That sounds right. I'm
that's
not sure
crazy.
If I was on the
that's
time, but
craziness, man.
Well, I'll tell you how crazy he was. He would not allow people to dance when we played, even if we were playing like a medium swing tune. So we were playing in Iowa once. I'll never forget this one. Playing at a place, it was almost like a VFW hall. It was like...
Well, what's in Iowa? I mean...
I don't know, but it was like a hall that was maybe 250, 300 people, most of them were all senior citizens, you know, the Buddy Rich Big Band, you know, and I, so all these old people came to see the gig, and we start playing a tune, I don't know, medium swing, I don't know what it was, and this little old couple gets up and starts doing a foxtrot right in the middle, right in front of the band. Boom, he stops right there, stops the whole band.
Oh, come on.
And he looks at them, he goes, nobody dances when Buddy plays, he says, sit down.
Holy shit.
And these poor little people, they were probably 7, 8, well, now I'm 7, probably 80.
Yeah, yeah, old.
And they were scared, and they just went, they went and they sat down, and that was it.
That's just, isn't that, that is just.
I know, but that's the kind of thing, man.
That's why there's jokes about, I heard, you heard the Buddy Rich joke, right, about the guy who calls Buddy Rich's house after he dies?
No.
Someone gets his number and he calls his house. He says, is Buddy Rich there? And he said, no, Buddy Rich passed away last week. He goes, okay. And he keeps calling back. And then finally said, why you just call? Why do you keep calling? Because I just want to hear it again.
That's a shame. But yeah, you know, he had good
times. You know, the problem is, it's like you get to a point, right, where you become like a god. I've seen this happen.
Yeah.
You lose yourself because you think you're something special, I guess.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, he was treated like royalty.
He grew up at 3 years old. He was playing drums.
I understand.
So
he was
from 3 years old, he was a phenomenon.
He was a freak. He was what he was. He was a freak.
And, you know, I guess it went through his head, you know, because you could be that great and be a great person.
There's plenty of guys like that.
I know. Yeah. So, but what are you going
to
do?
You know, I went to school with guys that were, you know, Weckl and Joel. I mean, they were, you know, the guys were like freaks. They were, you know, and I thought that was normal. I thought when you go to college, that's the kind of the way people play. And I didn't realize I was in the midst of that.
Right. Wow.
It's true. Because I went from being the best drummer in Islip to the worst drummer in Connecticut.
Well, you're competing with Dave Weckl.
Well, yeah. I went to the first, my roommate was a drummer.
What school was that?
University of Bridgeport.
Oh, okay.
1979. So
they had a good jazz program there, right?
Yeah, Neil Slater was there.
Yeah.
I mean, those guys were all players. And some, like the first week of school in September of 79, my roommate and I said, okay, well, let's go check out the jazz audition. There was an A band and a B band. We walked down. I only looked through the glass of the Bernhard Center where guys were starting to assemble. There was a million horn players, a million trump, whatever. Like, I would say 12 drummers. And Weckl was playing. And we sat there for a minute, and we turned around, went back to. I said, "I'm not even auditioning for this." that's right. And this is what's crazier is the following semester. So this was like September. The following semester, which was I guess February or something, was the same school year. I'm pretty sure. Dave left, and now so Joel was the other A band drummer. Wait, I'm sorry, I got that wrong. Something happened mid semester, where. Okay, so Dave was in the A band, Joel was in the B band. That's what happened. Two guys out of 12 made it. Dave Weckl and Joel Rosenblatt. So I think there were maybe two drummers in the B band, and something happened. That guy left. They re-auditioned, and I made the B band. So now it was Weckl in the A band and me and Joel in the B band, and we had a routine. We had to go. So the A band rehearsed at like 8 o'clock or something. B band rehearsed at 6. So you had to meet Dave at the B band rehearsal at 6, set up his drums with him because he had to use them for the B band.
Oh, wow.
We had to go there, help him set up, and then he'd leave and he'd come back at 8 and his shit was set up already. That was the routine.
Do you stay in touch with him at all?
Who?
Dave Weckl?
Yeah, well, once in a while. Yeah.
That's cool.
I asked him to do this podcast, but he's like, he's still too busy, man.
Yeah.
You know what's funny? You want to hear something funny?
Well, he's really in his own class. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
it's funny. Dave is... He's a certain way. Like he's born for this. He says this in an interview with Don Famularo. My friend Frank called me one night and said, hey, "Listen, man, I just listened to this interview with Dave Weckl, and he mentioned you and your podcast.
Wow.
That he knew you."
Yeah.
So I called Frank back. He would answer. I go and I download the interview. It was a joke. He didn't mention me, but I happened to. It was, of course, it was funny, but. Yeah. I happen to watch the whole thing, and Dave and I see eye to eye on a lot of stuff. Dave's like, no shit. He's like, look, man, if this is not happening, don't just go elsewhere. If you're not getting what this is, you know, right. It's like drums chose me. I didn't choose drums. If you chose drums or chose something because you think it's some other thing or you want to be famous or you want the attention, that's not the way it works. Right. You know, it's supposed to be something that's in you that falls out of you. That's music. Exactly. You know what I mean? And that's him. Yeah. That's definitely him.
That's cool, man. Yeah. That's good.
I remember we were doing a small group thing one time. We were doing small group jazz, and they recorded it. And me and Joel were playing in one of the small group jazz things, and I'm playing in the thing, and my hi-hat stand breaks in the middle of it. No. It's like, and on the tape, you can hear like a metallic click where it breaks, and there's no more hi-hat. So it was funny. So we came back to the dorm, we played it for Dave, and he listened, then he laughed. But then he whipped out like four recordings. Hey, here's a guy playing jazz with no hi-hat. Here's a guy playing jazz with all hi-hats on. He was like the guy,
he knew
everything about everything. He was that guy.
That's cool. Yeah, you know, those people come along once in a lifetime, you know.
Yeah, it was a great experience, man.
But I would say Weckles really was the guy that created that style almost of playing. Yeah. Like, you know, I mean, you got your Steve Gadd or something.
Yeah, well, we all listened to Steve Gadd in Bridgeport. That's where I heard about it.
Elvin Jones, it's another whole style of drumming. Mm-hmm. You know, just as great, but very different.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
Buddy Rich was another style. Yep. I mean, but Weckl almost created that style that he has.
He was ahead of his time in a lot of ways, man. Just even with they was like all encompassing. He didn't just play drums. He was like the equipment. He knew how to tune drums. He was experimenting in sizes. He's the first guy to do an X hat. You know, that happened in Bridgeport.
This is an X hat, the right-handed
hi hat.
Oh,
so he was doing a gig at the school, and he said, "You guys want to come check out this new thing I'm doing?" And we went there, and it was two hi hats. I was like, "Wow, two hi hats!" That started in 1979 in Bridgeport, man.
Wow, two hi hats. I'm not sure how would you use it.
Because now you're not relegated to just kind of the over crossover thing when you're playing hi-hat. Now you can open up to your right side
you don't have a bass drum, right? Or no?
No, this stays closed.
Oh.
And now they have double pedals where you can work it as an hi-hat.
Oh, really? Yeah, oh my God. Because I remember when I started with the double bass drums, I'm like, oh my God, you know, one's not enough, you know?
Yeah, now it's not. You have to have all this other shit going on.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I think one bass drum's too much. I'm like, going, I want to bring a snare drum, and that's it, man. One snare drum, one cymbal.
Oh, gee. But it's great. Yeah, so, you know, trying to think of any more funny buddy stories. That's about it, as far as I can remember. But the tapes, I've still got recordings of those tapes, those buddy tapes.
Tapes.
And you know about the Seinfeld episodes with there's three Seinfeld episodes that they use a quote from Buddy Rich. Did you know?
No.
You didn't know this?
No.
Oh, you got to Google it. It's great. Jerry Seinfeld is a big Buddy Rich, I don't know, not a fan, I would say, but he was into Buddy Rich's stuff. And there's three quotes in the Seinfeld series that was directly taken because it was Buddy Rich's quote.
Well, what are the quotes?
I don't remember all of them. One of them is like,
how did he even know Buddy Rich quotes? This quotes like from
because
Buddy
of the tapes, the Buddy Rich tapes. He had listened to the. If you Google Jerry Seinfeld, Buddy Rich, there's an interview with him, and he's talking about he heard these tapes of Buddy Rich and everything.
Is that the one where he's yelling at the band on the bus?
No, but one of them is like when George is. You seen Seinfeld?
Yeah.
There's an episode where George is in the theater, and the guys are behind him are talking and stuff, and he turns around, he says, "Hey." He says, my buddy says, if you don't take it outside, I'll take it outside. And that's exactly Buddy Rich's quote.
Right.
And there's another one. There's two more. My memory.
That's great. Isn't it? Any idea?
Yeah, you got to look at that. That's really cool. It's good stuff.
Well, okay. You got anything else, man? That's it?
No, I mean, that's pretty much. I mean,
all right, that's a lot, Sal.
Yeah.
You got your clip notes, everything? Everything covered there? Your resume out?
Oh, well, we only covered my first 30 era years of my music performance years. My other 30 years in administration is another whole hour.
I'll have to do the AD version of Sal.
One more just quick story. This is a good Glenn Drew story because Glenn's a good friend of mine.
Yeah, Glenn's great.
You know, when I got off the road with Buddy, he didn't talk me into it, but we talked about it. I said, yeah, I'm going to get into the Broadway scene. So I got an apartment.
Glenn did?
Yeah, because Glenn was getting into the Broadway scene. Because we were on Buddy's band together. We were on Ham's band together. So I get an apartment on the Upper West Side, and I want to break into the Broadway scene. So I get this apartment. It's like $200 a month. Cockroaches all over
$200
the place.
$200 a month, huh?
Yeah, two cockroaches. You know, the cockroaches were free. They were part of the rent.
Yeah.
You know, it was like part of utilities. So he tells me, okay, here's what you got to do. He says, you got to get your name out there. So back then, I don't know if they still do it, the Roseland Ballroom, the musicians on a Wednesday afternoon, all the 802 players and musicians would all meet there on a Wednesday afternoon, and they would walk around and with their little black books and say, hey, you got anything for Friday night? Yeah, you got a Saturday? I'm looking for a Saturday night.
To get to play gigs.
And people would network, and that's how they would do it, because back then there wasn't the internet.
Right.
You didn't have an internet, that was the internet, was the Roseland Ballroom.
Yeah, I used to have a book. I used to have a book for musicians. Yeah.
So Glenn, you know, he was, and to this day, Glenn's still doing Chicago. It's one of the longest running shows ever on Broadway, and he's got a great, he's got the opening lead solo on stage.
He's great, man.
Glenn's been doing Broadway for, you know, since, you know, 50 years now. But, so he shows me, you know, the ropes, and he says, all right, here's what we're going to do. He says, we're getting to Roseland. He said, there was a front desk, and you would ask for people. You know, you would say, Bill Hackenblack, come to the front desk, please. And so he would go up there, and he'd ask for me. because he said, if you get your name out there on the PA, he says, people get to know you. So we'd go there, and so, like, we'd be there for like a couple hours, and every like 20, 30 minutes, he'd go up there and say, could you page Sal Randazzo, please? Sal Randazzo to the front. And so, you know, people, oh, Sal, he must be a busy guy. Right, you know, everybody's asking for Sal Randazzo.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, so that's what we did. But, you know, I got very disillusioned. I think I might have subbed once on some show.
That's a whole other thing.
Off-Broadway show. But I'm not a city guy.
Yeah.
I to this day, I like going in the city just to visit. But I didn't. First of all, I had a horrible apartment. I wasn't into it, and I just. That's when I decided to go back onto Long Island, and I went into education.
Plus the shows they get tedious after a while, man.
It's not my thing. Yeah. But so that was it. That's how I got into education from that disillusionment to go, and I went to the defunct Dowling College. I went and got my music ed degree. And I started teaching, and I went through all of that stuff and administration, and you know, that's another whole podcast.
And now you're getting a pension. Yeah.
That's it. And
that's
now,
it, man.
Now I'm the retired
pension,
and I'm,
that's it.
I'm having the best time of my life.
Well, thanks for doing this, Al. Those are good stories, man.
Thank you for having me. This is great. It was an honor to have me and to have the podcast. And I look forward to
listening to more
of your podcast. You got a great thing. It's a great service you do.
Thanks. Cool. Listen, a couple people.
It's fun.
It's funny.
All right, cool.
All right. Take it easy.
Bye-bye.